We'll start with the first slide. Have you ever felt like this? I think often we have those days and moments where we'd like to just check out, put the kids in the deep freeze and wait a couple years until we're ready for them to come back out again. Next slide. This is a definition of burnout. This defines, let's go back to the other one. Push the bottom button and that reverses it.
There's something going on here.
You have an automatic.
Oh. Something on that I'm not doing.
Our projector is going crazy.
Something like that.
What?
Betty?
We got it.
Okay. You're just going between the two. Now you're going forward. Okay. We're automatically forwarding and we don't want to move the projector.
Oh, you're automatically.
Is that a timer?
Is there an auto button?
There, we're back at the beginning. There, this is where we want to be. Okay, this is our definition of burnout, the progressive loss of idealism, energy, and purpose as a result of the condition of one's work. This definition comes from a book on burnout written for professionals in helping professions, specifically social workers. The first person to publish a book in coining the term burnout was writing it for people who worked in social work, counseling families in trouble and dealing with people who were drug dependent and abusive parents. They found that people who work in helping professions often get to a point in their career where they are just exhausted and they feel that they have no more energy to go on and that they don't have any more strategies to use that will work for the people they're trying to help. And as I read through that book on the helping professions, I realized that there were a lot of parallels to parenting. Parenting has some of the same frustrations and some of the same reasons for being frustrated. The next slide then. The first part of the burnout process is initial enthusiasm. And I think most of us, as we start out in our relationships and plan to have a family, we have this wonderful enthusiasm about what it's going to be like, what that new addition to the family will be like, how it's going to make our family whole, what the baby experience is going to give us as people, and how it will enrich our lives. And that is a part of parenting. Unfortunately, I think sometimes we don't get the more realistic part of parenting, and when we start out, we really are very idealistic. Another component is a lack of criteria for measuring our accomplishments. How do we know that we're good parents? Do we know that we're good parents because our children are dressed neat and clean and other people say how polite they are? Do we know they're good because they don't cry at night and they go to bed good or because they eat all their vegetables? Do we know that they're good because they grow up to be productive adults? You know, that's a long time to wait to measure the criteria that you have, whether you're a good parent or not. And I think part of the component is we're not getting feedback about what kind of parent we're doing. We have our children's behavior to go on, but that always doesn't reflect what kind of parent we are. Children are born with different sets of personalities and characteristics, and they make different choices about how to behave. Sometimes we may help develop that, but we don't have ultimate control over how that child behaves. And I think a lot of our guilt traps about being parents are when our children are misbehaving, we somehow feel that it's all our fault, that we must have done something wrong. So measuring whether we're good parents is a component because we all like to know that we're doing a good job as we go along the way. If you're in some work environments, you're rewarded at work. You know that you're doing well because you're evaluated periodically and you have this little form someone fills out and checks off all the things you do well, or they give you a raise, or they at least don't fire you. If you're doing a good job, you still have your job. But parenting doesn't have those kinds of rewards. We also have to consider the fact that we're not really getting paid in the sense of a monetary reward for parenting. In fact, we put out a lot of money to bring up children in the world, and no one's paying us in monetary means for having that child. What kind of reward or pay do we get? You know, we get kids that are cranky and grumpy sometimes, and kids that sass back, and kids that turn 14 and are bored with everything. And we often don't get the kind of reward that we set ourselves up for expecting. When we're very idealistic, we think this child's going to be happy and smiley and gurgly and cuddly, and it's going to give us a lot of tactile rewards and a lot of personal, interpersonal kinds of rewards, and that may or may not happen, and if it does, it may be a long time before the child develops to the point where he can really contribute to the relationship in a way that gives you something back. So the pay is not always good, and you don't always feel acknowledged or appreciated for the effort you're making as a parent. In fact, there are a lot of times when your children challenge the efforts that you're making. You know, how come you're always ordering me around? Or what gives you the right to make all the rules? It's a constant struggle to remind yourself that you set limits because you care, and you encourage your children to take responsibility for their actions because that's how you feel you responsibly behave as a parent. And children don't always like that, and they don't want to hear that. The other part about parenting is there really is no career advancement. You don't get promoted. You don't move up in the system. You think about your children going through different stages, but you get through one stage that has certain difficulties and you move into another one that may have different difficulties. At first, you have that 24-hour a day responsibility where your child is going to communicate usually by crying to meet its needs. So you're constantly responsible for feeding and changing and holding and occupying that baby's time. And you think, boy, if they'll just get so that they can talk, that's really going to make things easier. Then they do start to talk, and all you hear is this constant babble, and you think, oh, if I just had a moment of silence, how nice that would be. Then they get developed to the point where they can argue with you and debate everything, and they want to carry everything to great lengths of, why do we have this rule, and I don't think that's fair. We really just keep moving into progressive stages that offer different benefits, but they also offer different challenges to us as parents. So we can't get more stripes on our shoulder, and maybe that's something we should think about, is giving ourselves a stripe every year that we progress and get into another stage. There are some kind of male and female components also to burnout. If you think about traditional values or roles in parenting, as I look back at the way my parents parented, it was very divided. My mother had the responsibility pretty much for taking care of the young children in the home, day and night. You know, it was very rare that my father got up at night to feed the child. So it really was her role to give that kind of 24-hour, always available on the spot kind of taking care of the needs. On the other hand, she was there to see the first smile and to watch the babies begin to crawl and to watch the small triumphs that happen day to day. Whereas my father, being out in the work world, didn't have the same kind of 24-hour a day contact, which can be very draining, but he always also missed some of those first time achievements and some of the closeness kinds of things. It really pleases me now to see parenting roles melding more now, to the point where fathers also not only share some of the day-to-day responsibilities, but they're getting to experience some of that closeness and nurturing and bonding in a different way than people who just weren't available for that. Whereas the mothers now get some of the benefits of being able to take time out, to be able to go and do some activities away from the children and kind of get a relief system going. Lack of support systems, I think, is a real important component of burnout. In the days when extended families lived close to each other, parents often found that their children were sharing households. They'd go stay with an aunt and uncle during hay time to help, or they would be with the grandparents part of the time. And there was just sort of this homogeneous body of children and adults kind of intermingling and sharing. And I think in many ways that was important for both the children and adults. They got a little vacation from each other. They also got some feedback on their behavior and the value systems that were important to the family. Now, often with our nuclear families, we don't have that. We're such a mobile society that couples having babies are often you know, across the country from grandparents and extended families. So they are there in a household with those children and don't have other people to share that parenting with. So part of the strategies I think we'll talk about is how to create your own extended families within your environment. Who is there out there that's a potential extended family? Part of the support of extended families also was that there was a reinforcement for your value system. Families, if they were church-going families, all went, and children grew up expecting that this was what families did, and that the values that were talked about were the ones shared by everyone, and that it wasn't so odd or abnormal to go to church. Sometimes we get the messages now from our children that, oh, we're really weird. We're the only ones whose parents make us go to church, you know. Or, well, so-and-so says it's fine to sneak into the swimming pool on someone else's pass, you know. And then you get into these dialogues about, you know, where do we develop our values and how do we make our choices and where does that all come from? And if you're the parents alone out there speaking for that, it's a lot harder than if you have an extended family all reinforcing your value system. At least for me, it's been that way. I think sometimes, too, we get caught by our desire to prioritize everything at the top, to want to be everything all the time to our children, and forgetting that no one has enough hours or energy in the day to be everything to everyone, that we need to start thinking in terms of triage, which is the word for setting priorities. In a medical setting, if there's mass casualties, you walk through quickly and you decide who's on the verge of dying and has no hope, who can you help if you intervene quickly, who's not hurt bad enough that they can't wait a couple hours. And you go through and develop in your mind a way of sorting things out. And I think we can begin attitudinally to figure out ways in our parenting day to set priorities. I've had to struggle with this for years and decided that having clean clothes, having cookies in the cookie jar all the time was not as important as taking a walk to fly a kite. And I think sometimes we need to really think about what is it that's important? What will our children remember about our parenting? I don't remember having clean clothes particularly, but I do remember my father reading us a story every night. Every single night we had a story and sat in his lap in the big chair. And those were the things that I think we remembered as important, and not whether we went to Kentucky Fried Chicken one night or whether we had an elaborate gourmet meal. I think too often the philosophy over the last 15, 20 years has been to sacrifice all your own needs for your children. There was kind of a trend in child psychology, so to speak, to allow the freedom of expression, encourage your children to speak out their feelings, to be available to them, to never turn them off, to always let them know that you were non-judgmental and open to whatever they had on their minds. And while there is real truth and value in some of that, I think in some cases we sacrifice our own needs in terms of always being available. The quality of our availability time, I think, is the clue there. Can you have quality available time if you're always available, if you never take time for your solitude, if you never take time for your adult relationships? Those things are things I think that as we bring up our children, I would like to give them the message that they don't need to feel that a child is necessarily a burden because they can't be a person in their own right anymore. That we need to let our children know that there's adult time, there's child time, there's family time, there's private time, and you need to kind of protect that. In the book on burnout for the health professionals, there were 5 stages of burnout that they identified, and they went through and did research on helping professionals, and they categorize these different stages. The first was initial enthusiasm and high ideals. They saw people coming out of college, coming out with a wealth of new skills, and boy, they were going to save the world. They were going to enter their profession and do a lot of good. And people's lives would change because of their intervention, and things were going to be a whole lot better. Well, then they got down to the nitty-gritty of coming to work every day and dealing with people many times that didn't want to change. For many people who were locked into choices that They either didn't feel capable of changing or didn't choose to change or were so set that they were getting what they wanted out of the way they behaved. And they got to the point where they were in stagnation phase. This was the point where they would sit around and just look at themselves and think, is this all there is? This isn't really what it was cracked up to be. This isn't what I expected. And as a parent, I felt this way. I was trained as a nurse, and I did a little babysitting as a teenager, but that was very different than having a baby home in the household. In the nursery at the hospital, I took care of babies, and I thought technically I was really competent. I knew how to feed them and change them and take care of their navels and all those things. But having that baby home when I had my first to be responsible for, that was a whole different ballgame. That baby wanted things all day and all night. And sometimes I did all the technical things I knew to do, and that wasn't enough. That baby still cried. And the message to me then was, if your baby's crying, your baby's not happy, and that's not right. Somehow there was something more I was supposed to be doing so that that baby would quit crying and go to sleep or at least sit there and be happy. And it was a difficult process to come to the realization that not all babies are happy all the time. In fact, no babies are happy all the time. And there may be a limit to what you can do for that baby to be comfortable. Frustration is the next stage described, that after this, is this all there is question, you begin to feel anxious, that you should be doing more, that there must be something lacking in yourself that's not working, or that maybe you weren't really cut out for this in the first place, or did other people feel like this? You know, it's hard for us, I think, to acknowledge to each other that we get stressed and that we're frustrated. The next stage in the book was apathy, that after the frustration anxiety stage, people became apathetic. They no longer cared. They'd get up and they'd go to work because it was a job, but they no longer shared any special energy with the people that they worked with. They no longer felt that they were contributing to a changing world. They just felt dead inside, empty inside. And this, to most people, is real disturbing, to feel empty and to feel powerless. At that point in the book, they describe the last stage as being intervention. Now, this kind of struck me as maybe not always ringing true, because I know many people who stay in their jobs in that apathetic, empty state forever until they retire. Do any of you know people who work at their jobs, who aren't excited about their jobs, who stay there because they feel obligated to support the family or bring home the paycheck, or that they don't have any skills or any special thing to change jobs, that that's just finally a thing that they accept and go about? The book, however, dealt with, at this point where people are that apathetic, often an intervention will occur. The person gets so distressed over feeling that way that they quit the profession, go do something else, or they change their skill level so they move into administration and maybe away from the direct contact, which has its own frustrations, or they somehow have a crisis that occurs in their life that really challenges them to take a look at their priorities, take a look at their perception of how things are happening. And I think what Rich was offering in his rational thinking session was that we do have some choices to change our perceptions and our attitudes about what we're doing. And that's the exciting part of our lives, is that by making some different choices, by mobilizing some support systems, by choosing different strategies to use, we can get out of that apathetic or that frustrated mode. We'll get a little more into this in terms of the parenting in just a few minutes, but I would like to tell you some ways that frustrations and burnout are expressed in our lives. How do we tell if we're experiencing burnout? Sometimes we can't tell in real obvious ways. So we'll go to the next slide. Often we have physical symptoms, and Rich in his anger session brought out that family practitioners will often be able to tell you that 70% of the people coming to them with physical symptoms have some issues that they're dealing with, such as repressed anger or the inability to communicate what's going on with their feelings, that come out in physical symptoms. And as a nurse practitioner, which is kind of like being a family practitioner, many people have come to me with these symptoms that turn out to be an expression of what's going on in their life. It's not that they have a cancer growing, it's that they're having some difficulty communicating and negotiating in their lives to make it happen for them that their needs are met better. Many people come and say, I am tired all the time. This is one of the most common complaints that people come with to a healthcare provider. I get up in the morning and I'm tired. I go to bed at night and I'm tired. I have no energy. There must be something wrong with me. And that's true. There may be some physical reason, a hormone imbalance, a thyroid imbalance, some blood loss that you're not aware of or that you are aware of. There may be some physical mechanism for that tiredness. So the first obligation of the provider is to find out, you know, why are you having these symptoms? But if what they find out is that all the, quote, technology tells you everything's okay, you need to still search for what is going on in your life. Some of our semantics describe what's going on in our life, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Physical illnesses such as ulcers, migraine headaches, colitis, back pain, many of these have a component in them that include difficulty in expressing what's going on and communicating and negotiating with the people in your life for what you want. Unhealthy indulgences is the way I kind of put chemical dependencies, food dependencies, people who use their mouths to try to meet some of their needs, alcoholism, drug dependency, overeating. Indulgences is work. You know, workaholism is also an unhealthy indulgence if it's to the point where it is helping the relationships in your life deteriorate. And that's the last one, damage to personal relationships. I think we as parents know that when we get to the point of frustration where we're snapping back at people, or when we're nagging at our spouse maybe because we're so upset with what's going on with the kids that day, that damages those relationships. And we find that it's a vicious cycle. The more we nag and the more we gripe and the more we complain, the less nurturing we get, the more withdrawn those other people get. They want to stay away from us when we're in that kind of a mood and when we're snapping back in that manner. At some point, the damage to personal relationships from our frustrations can go to a real extreme. It may end in divorce. It may end in people physically or mentally running away from the situation. It may end in just a lot of hostile conflicts going on every day, people screaming and yelling and creating more distance and more hostility. Okay, next slide, please. Here's a couple examples of people's physical symptoms from stresses. The examples are from a different class I do on communication, so they're not necessarily about parenting. This poor guy has an ulcer because the IRS are going to audit him. Next. Next one. This is a woman who is saying, I can't stand much more of his constant fault finding. Everything's always my fault. Oh, this headache, this throbbing pain. How many dollars are spent on Excedrin? Remember the Excedrin headache, number 44, 37, whatever. When we think about the numbers of people who have, quote, tension headaches or even migraineous headaches, there's a vast majority of people in the country who have headaches. And as you begin to talk to these people about their lives, often there's things going on in their lives that they're not able to talk about to the people that are participating in it. Next. This is a mother that didn't quite all fit on, but she's saying, Julie, you're doing that all wrong. I knew I should never have let you help. You always mess up. And Julie's thinking, boy, I never do anything right. I must be really dumb. And I hear this happening with parents and children all over, in the grocery store or working on a project. And I myself have said things in very critical ways to my children. And when I look back at this, I feel real bad that the way I said it was a very negative, critical way. One gentleman yesterday suggested that we remember to use I statements. I feel. I suggest if you did it this way, it might work better. And I think that's a real clue and a real helpful clue to me, is to try to remember not to say you did this or did that or you better, but to try to say I feel or I think or why couldn't we try this together. Next. This woman is saying, what a marriage. We haven't spoken a nice word to each other all week. What happened to the knight in shining armor I married? Tonight I'm really going to give him what for. I think this kind of speaks to the mythology of marriage, that marriage is your knight in shining armor, rescuing from the outside world and protecting you and taking care of you the rest of your life, and that we need to give up that mythology for men's benefit as well as for women's, and think about a relationship being a mutual kind of support and caring. Next. This one didn't show up too well because it's so dark, but there's a what I think of as a mother and baby monkey. And mother's saying, here he goes again, Junior, spouting off again. And there's maybe the daddy monkey who is throwing a temper tantrum, an adult temper tantrum. And we use this in a class to illustrate people behaving in this way and how we can deal with a person's temper tantrum so that they get beyond that and learn other ways, or how we at least don't reinforce that or be manipulated by that temper tantrum. Next. Now, these are some of the things I think that set us up for unrealistic expectations. One is the media. I brought a few ads I cut out from papers that you can pass around or just look at, about the portrayal of children in advertising. And I think when you watch some of the television shows and see some of the movies, what you see are little babies that are asleep and in clean little jammies. Oh, they're so darling. Or you see this mother nursing a child and everything's so quiet and that child's not fussing and there's no one around wishing you'd hush it up. It's a very serene picture of a mother-child relationship. Here's this baby with its Junior baby food, you know. It doesn't have it slobbered all over the floor and all over its fingers. It's keeping it in the spoon and it's in its mouth. You know, I think they probably ran up between pictures and wiped it all off. Here's these neat little children with their wonderful educational toys, you know, all clean and dressed. They aren't standing there sticking their thumb out at their mother. You know, they're not over on daddy's leg pulling his pant like, daddy, daddy, I want this. Here's a little girl who's learning to be a wonderful parent. She's all dressed in her clean jammies and her baby's all dressed in her clean jammies and nobody's fussing and nobody's fitting up or messing their diapers. Here's a little child who's sick and needs an aspirin substitute, and the mother and child both smiling. How many sick kids are smiling? Sick kids don't feel good and they're cranky. That's one of the first clues that your children are sick. They whine and they don't want to go to bed and they don't want to play and they pull at their ear and they've got snot running down their noses. They don't look like that. Here's our happy little family on Valentine's Day, and the kids are up snickering on the stairway as Daddy and Mommy are giving each other their Valentines. You know, that's an idyllic picture. It's wonderful. But where are the pictures of people arguing about who's taking out the trash and go back to brush your teeth one more time? You didn't do it right. Here's children loving to learn, you know, all these wonderful educational toys. If you'll just buy your child a computer, they won't be kicked out of college. And I think about being bombarded with this as we're growing up. Is this what we did expect as parents? And it was what I expected. Here's a sign on cooking, and it says, Nobody cooks like you. And there's mom cooking and mom teaching the daughter to cook. I hate to cook. And I don't have any daughters, but so far none of my sons have wanted to cook either. There are people in the world who don't like to cook. And there are many women in the world that doesn't come, you're not born with this wonderful ability to cook. And I think that we set people up for expectations here. How many men married women expecting they'd love to cook for them? The way to a man's heart is through their stomach. How many women in the courtship game cooked meals for their people that were courting them to show them that they could cook or that to give them something as a gift, cooking meals? I did that when I courted the first time around, and my husband was very disgusted with me when he found out I did not cook anything but tuna casserole. Here's a picture of a boy complaining about the size of his sandwich in order to sell sandwich stuffing stuff. And the first time I looked at this, I thought, you know, here's a picture of a boy with an ugly look on his face, and that's very unusual. But then the message to me was, if your boys look at you ugly, you'll go out and buy them better sandwich stuff. You know, you don't tell them, well, make yourself another one if it didn't sell you ugly. And I wonder, you know, why did they pick a boy? Why didn't they pick a girl with an ugly look on her face saying she didn't get enough to eat? You know, it's kind of these subtle things that click every now and then. Here's these kids all ready for bed, and look at those brothers and sisters. They've got their arms around each other. They're taking care of each other and they like each other. Here is a little boy in his little sweater and white shirt. His parents are getting him a computer because he's going to grow up and go to college and be smart. Here's a little girl whose mother has taught her how to make a cake mix. And I think these are things we need to look at with a sensitivity to whether they portray us the way we want to be portrayed, whether they give a message to our children that our children would want. You know, if we let our children make our advertisements for us, what would they pick? You know, what would they want to see? I think they'd come up with some real different things. Okay. Another thing I think that leads to unrealistic expectations is we have a wealth of experts now. Experts that tell us how to be a good parent and what's the right way to parent. Unfortunately, when you start looking through the experts' material, there's a broad range of what's right and what's wrong. You can pick people from one end of the spectrum that are very authoritarian, that use words like the willful child, the discipline of control, the balance of love and control, who's in power. There is another extreme of experts that don't mention power at all. They talk about logical and natural consequences, allowing children to behave their behavior and just kind of see what happens and what naturally would be a consequence. And then there's a whole bunch of people kind of in between. I think experts are important because they help to give us different viewpoints. They help to give us different strategies. Experts in terms of teaching us what normal development is about and giving us ideas that we might incorporate that work well for us and help build self-esteem are really crucial. But I think sometimes we can be trapped by the aura of an expert. Sometimes I would go to a trendy book and read it and think, oh yeah, this is just what I need. I'm feeling frustrated, I'm feeling powerless, I'm going to do all this says. And yet, as I began to try it out, some of those things didn't fit for me. They weren't comfortable, they didn't even seem like good common sense. And I think we need to remind each other that we often sell ourselves short. We do have some common sense, we do have some basic good sense. In, quote, the old days, people didn't read authorities about parenting. They just did parenting. Sometimes that was not the best parenting because we often model our parenting after our parents' parenting. And if we didn't have healthy parenting, we grew up to be the same kind of parent.
But I think in a way people were more comfortable being parents because they just acted like, quote, a parent acted. You know, children were to be seen and not heard. Everybody in the family participated in the work of the family, and people didn't challenge that. At bedtime, it was bedtime, and you may or may not have had much rebellion about bedtime if you were from a family where it was very clear from the very beginning that 7 o'clock all the little ones went to bed. That was just the way it is. And I think we need to remind ourselves that we have some inner skills and some common sense we can use, and that experts can be very helpful if we try to evaluate what they're telling us. Does it fit for our beliefs? Does it sound like it makes sense to us? Or is it pretty far out? Or is it going to be uncomfortable? Or do we just not buy it? Do we just not agree with what that person said? I think most of us in some situations wish that we can be better parents than our own parents. No one has a perfect parent. Although some of us choose to deny what we think of as the negative parts of our parent, if we really realistically think about parenting, we can think of some instances where we wish our parents had done it differently. Or maybe if we were in the same situation, we'll handle it differently than they did. And I think that's positive, that's evolving, that's creative, that helps us move forward. It also, in one way, might make us believe that the way to be a good parent is to be perfect, because we don't want to make the mistakes of our parents. And I think that's a trap. It's kind of double-edged. If we try to be perfect, we don't give our children the permission to be imperfect. We don't give ourselves the permission to be imperfect. We don't give ourselves that out to be able to say, hey, I made a mistake, or hey, I wish I hadn't said that to you. And I think we need to remember that we're not perfect either. We don't have to feel we need to be perfect. And that in itself is a healthy message for our children, that they also have the freedom to make mistakes and to come to us and say, I made a mistake. Or, Mom, I felt real bad when you said that to me. And you can say, you're right, I felt bad later having said that. I think we have a lack of experiences now in terms of role models, that because we're such a mobile society, often we move away from role models that were good for us. Or because many of us are involved in the workaday world, we don't have the same kind of support system that women who were home parenting in the daytime had. The coffee clutches served a real significant part of women's lives, where they could get together and share with each other their frustrations, what they did with kids at different ages. It gave them a time out in a way that the children could all play together, maybe in the backyard, where the women sat over coffee and talked about the struggles with parenting and what was going on in their life. Now with people out working, we don't have that opportunity to get in touch with other mothers. And somehow I think we have to build that in, have to figure out ways to make that happen. How many of us have had a mentor as a parent? An adult figure that's done their parenting, that's around to give us some nurturing and support as a parent, to say, hey, I really like the way you handle that. Or, you know, I remember when my kids did that, and it's really hard, isn't it? You know, we lose out on those mentors unless we really seek them out and build them into our situation. Next slide. These are part of the reality. Dad, do I get my allowance or not? Is he ready to crash the cymbals on Sunday morning when it's only time that Dad gets to sleep in? Those aren't things we thought about, although some of us probably read Dennis the Menace, that are the reality of having kids. Next. You won't be losing a daughter. We're going to live here. She brings home this outrageous boyfriend. We don't always get what we expect in our children or in the friends that they've picked. Next. Okay. These are the stages then that I've kind of identified for parent burnout. You get to the point where the reality of parenting really does set in. You realize that you may have wanted that Gerber baby or expected that, but what you got was a real baby, one that cries, that fusses, that gets colic, that messes its pants, that needs to have a babysitter you trust if you want to get time out. That maybe you feel that there are times when you're the only one that knows how to satisfy that baby, or you wish you knew because you don't know and nobody else does either. And then I think often we get to the stage where we do lose some of that initial enthusiasm and we really get tired. Our energy's depleted. We're not getting enough positive energy coming in to fill up our stores, and it's more of an outpouring of energy. And we often get to the point where we are frustrated. We get irritable, cranky, and we may lash out at people, or we may just be disgusted at the whole thing, or we may even get to the point where we really wish someone would take that child, at least till you can re-establish your own boundaries and your own energy level. And I think when it gets to that point, the root feeling is powerlessness. How do you control your life so that you feel in control? How do you make things happen in your life so that they're positive and nurturing for you, so that you can give that to your children? I think that we'll stop here for now and just open it up for some discussion, recognizing that tomorrow we're going to talk about some negative responses to burnout, some ways that people cope with this, and then some positive responses to burnout, along with some strategies and a handout on a whole different set of ideas that people can utilize to deal with frustrations of parenting. Do people have comments about anything? Yes.
I do. When you were talking about the lack of criteria for measurement, mm-hmm. I remember having children in my early 30s and having had jobs and always being going to school. And I depended on a monthly paycheck or a quarter ending. And when I got into the parenting, there wasn't any break in time. So there was this, yeah. I didn't have anything to say, okay, I'm going to make it this far and then I'll get to kind of regroup. There wasn't any of that.
I think that's really important that you don't have milestones in the same sense. It just goes on. And one thing that helped me was to get from the parent education at our community college a little diagram of cycles of development. And they have plotted, by watching children, when there are the high cycles of activity and intellectual or physical growth, and when there are kind of the mellow out times. And that really helped me because I could look at the times when things were really outrageous, like between 1.5 and 2, when that child is beginning to break away from you as, you know, a very twosome unit to saying, no, don't help me up the stairs. You know, this is a very difficult period. And I could look at that cycle and I could see, gee, at 3 they mellow out and they're a lot more fun and they kind of want to go along on all the trips. And that helped me to read the developmental books again and have this posted on the refrigerator saying, there is a cycle here and pretty soon it's going to start going down. I think adolescence is another extremely challenging time. And we have 3 teenage boys, and when they woke up on their 14th birthday, they were horrid. And they were like that for 9 months. And we thought, what did we do to deserve this? It helped me to go to a parents and teen class. It helped me to try to talk to the teenagers about how they felt about the way they were acting, and they felt just as bad as I did, and to know that it was going to end. It helped more after the first one got through it, and we could look forward to the next two as it being temporary. And that's where I think talking to other parents where they can say, this is temporary, or I remember those terrible twos, that's a terrible time. And you're right, though, that there's no milestones, and one strategy might be to create artificial milestones. I think celebrations of events makes a real difference to the children as well as the adults. You know, not only celebrating the birthday, but celebrating the end of a school year, celebrating getting your driving permit, celebrating shaving, you know, celebrating the first womanhood for a girl. Those kinds of things, I think, often help us remember the playful part of families to build in some celebration.
Yeah. I think another thing that to go along with that, at least for me, we just have a little 1-year-old. And one thing that I experience is needing to find different ways that I can experience success. Mm-hmm. Because in a working situation, there's feedback that you're getting from other people. And when you're at home with your child, it's totally different. It's like needing to get a different mindset.
Mm-hmm. I think that's crucial. You know, who tells you you're successful? Your child doesn't tell you. Maybe you really have to look at the changes in behaviors and the ways that they're accomplishing new tasks, or to have external people reaffirming your successes.
They somehow see success in a dishes.
Yeah, yeah. I think those little successes are great.
Yeah.
I like to comment on the feeling of success from a parent's point of view, I guess from somebody that works. I guess I don't agree with most of the things I've heard about having difficulty measuring success as a parent. Whereas in the workforce, you can do this very easily.
Well, not
easily. I get the sheets with the evaluations every year and the discussions with the boss and the checkoff. And really, this amounts to almost nothing compared to the feelings of success or failure that I get from my children. They're much more vocal, much more straightforward, and I guess I just can't agree. I think that children are constantly, from day one, feeding back to you how well you are doing. I also think that as children come and go through your home, you get to meet, at least in our home, you get to meet the products of an awful lot of other parents. And I think you can kind of do a little measurement there, because I know there are kids that come to our home that I like, and there are kids that come to our home that I'm not too fired up about. So I think there are lots of yardsticks of your own parenting, and probably more so than in the workforce.
I think that's crucial. In my description of the workforce, it wasn't to suggest that the workforce approves of what you do and supports what you do in many instances. I think you're right that the real sense of achievement comes from your interpersonal relationships at home and the intimacy of that. And I think it's true that as we watch children coming and going, we measure our parenting ability sometimes by comparing. And in some ways that's good, and in other ways there may be some negative components.
Well, that was really neat to hear, because after I got, I'm sure that when I was at home I glamorized my job. You know, I just remembered all the things that I did well.
I think maybe when your children are grown, hopefully that's what we'll remember, is what we did well in those positives.
I think one of the major things that I as a mother have had to face, and my most difficult thing, is finding the today's societal values that a mother is not, a woman is not successful unless she is involved in the outside workforce as well as being a mother and a wife. And we are now starting to swing down to where it's okay, and it's a matter of pride if a woman can be in her home and be happy. But it has taken me almost all of my oldest daughter, who's now 13 and a half in a trying time anyway, to finally be happy to being a mother, because I have had to fight the beginning of the women's lib throughout the whole time of having to work and be a mother and be successful in absolutely everything I do, because society says if you're staying at home, you're nothing. And I think that's very difficult for us to overcome.
I think it is very difficult to feel comfortable with your choice, whether it's to work and do everything at home also, which has been a heavy trip, or to feel good about choosing to stay at home. Certainly, you are going against the tide of the media and the power of the women's movement, encouraging women to get out. And there was that negative message to women who chose to stay at home, that somehow you're not as good as we are, somehow you're not supportive of us. And hopefully, we are bridging those differences. I hope that that's happening, and that more people are saying that they are not judging someone else's choice because they're choosing their way. And I think that there is a tremendous amount of guilt, whatever choice you make, in trying to be a good parent, because I think many of us at the root hope to be a good parent, first of all. And when we also want to do other things, or whether we are home putting all our energy into being parenting, we still feel that that question of, am I a good parent? And I think for a lot of us, it's very difficult to acknowledge the negative feelings of parenting. And it's been a struggle for me to admit that I can be angry with my children, angry with my spouse, angry with myself. And the session on anger reminded me of what an ongoing journey that is for me, to try to figure out where that anger is coming from, or if I really choose to be angry at that or not. I'm now a step-parent, and it's been a very different challenge than parenting my own natural child. I have very different barriers and restrictions, and often I'll be very angry with a stepchild where I won't respond except to go away and pout about it. Whereas if it had been my child, I would have right then said, you better stop. And it's a real different sense. I think exploring the different ways that we can learn to acknowledge that and express it in a healthy way is real liberating. Rich?
From one perspective, I believe the decision about how you're doing is a decision only you make yourself, regardless of what the external input is. Because I talk to a lot of people who get lots of positive feedback and choose not to believe it. And a lot of people who get no feedback and decide I'm the one who has to look at what's happening and decide how adequately I'm performing and make up my own mind. And other people have decided I'm not getting as much outside feedback as I need, I have to go ask for it. But then you got to choose to believe it when you hear it or not. So I think an awful lot of it is a decision you yourself make about what you're going to believe about your performance, and whether it's good enough or not.
I think that's excellent. I think in terms of bringing our children up, will they grow up to feel that confidence in their own ability to do a good job?
You know, is that something you can teach them?
Yeah.
To make those decisions about themselves?
How does that happen, you know, that a person grows up feeling that secure and confident and choosing that way?
You don't see it, the rewards, until much later. You know?
I think in some ways that's true, but I also can identify with what he said, that those very small triumphs you see on a daily basis can maybe carry you through. And you can celebrate those while you're waiting to see the end. And then I think too about the parents who have children who, quote, go astray. Children who did what they knew to be the very best, and their children still have fallen into trouble with the law, who have gotten into drugs, who, you know, don't live their lives in a way that the parent would have chosen. And, you know, there's a whole lot of reasons that that happened. I kind of tend to go with Rich's belief that that child has made a choice how he's going to behave, and in a way it frees the parent from feeling this tremendous guilt, like, I produced this criminal. But I think if we wait to be rewarded by how they turn out as an adult, you know, maybe that isn't going to happen.
No, but, you know, the indication is there that you did something right when they're...
When they do turn out all right.
When they're 20 years old.
Yeah, then maybe you can take credit for it if they turn out.
They won't move away from home.
Well, and maybe I want mine to move away from home. I keep telling you, when you're 18, you're going, you're going to be ready, and we're going to be ready, and you're going to have a wonderful life out there.
Then they come to you for advice after that.
That's okay.
Cammy?
Uh-huh.
In response to the question you're concerned about feeling successful, some of that, as I recall, is centered around strokes from outside people, you know, outside the family, you know, who knows I'm, you know, doing such a great job besides my kid. And I would cook spiritual dinners and have friends over, and that was kind of a fun way to be exposed to that somebody on the outside that said, hey, gee, this is great, can I have your recipes and all that, and then you feel like an adult again. Another way I got real involved, I had four little girls, and so I would, you know, I started sewing for them. And that was a real personal, successful feeling, to make these cute little things. And other people, of course, notice the minority. Oh, look at the video. And that's kind of fun to have outside people, outside this little family, say, gee, that's kind of neat.
I think that puts us in the other position, too, that now that we, you know, we're here talking about how we need to have a stroke, it's also our responsibility to those around us, to our friends, to our spouses, to say, you know, your child did such and such, and that was really neat. And I think it's important for our inner well-being to take us out of ourselves and into that other person and give another person some strokes.
Excellent. That's one of the things that we talk about tomorrow is how do we participate in a caring community of people who are parenting. One thing I think too for kids, it's just really important for us as parents of teenagers to get together as a giant group of people who have teenagers also, like a picnic or a potluck where the teens are there intermingling with the adults and where not only do they get to have some peer relationships, but they get some feedback from other adults about how they're behaving. You know, if they're really coming off the wall, sometimes someone else will go up and say, you know, boy, you're really pouty today, or, well, that was a sarcastic thing to say, or someone else will kind of kid them out of it and make a joke, or they'll say something really special to them and say, you know, I noticed that you helped to carry out all that heavy stuff for your mom. That was really a nice thing to do. And I think that being aware of all the things going on in the environment makes a real difference. I think grandparents can play a real significant role as the next generation comes along. And my children relate to my parents in a very different way than I did, and my parents relate to them differently because they don't have that same everyday responsibility. They really are having fun with their grandchildren, and their grandchildren feel so pampered and so cared about there that they'll often do things for the grandparents that they would never lift a finger to do at home. It's a nice way to have a different kind of relationship.
How many times have you seen in a shopping center or wherever, the child is tired, and I don't know if we did this as well. We probably did, but you can see it in other people eating. You know, the mother reaches down and swats a kid, and all the kid is just tired. Didn't want to be there in the shopping cart or in a hot sticky diaper or something. She wanted to be at home sleeping. Economics played into why she couldn't get a babysitter or something.
I thought
you'd be like going up and saying something, yeah, come on.
Some people do. At one time I saw that and I went up and I say, it must be really hard to shop with that toddler. Would you like me to just take him and walk around for a few minutes? And I did that and I thought, I wish somebody had done that. But I think if shopping centers had a play corner and a person there to supervise, you know, everyone would go to that store to shop because it's so difficult to shop with little ones. Mm-hmm. Or if somehow they worked it out so they didn't have to take little ones, that's finally what I did, is I left them somewhere else when I went shopping, and I loved going shopping with no kids. But I think you're right. Do we reach out to people? And if we do reach out to someone who's feeling bad anyway, how do we approach them so that we're not threatening or not critical? You know, what can we say to someone in the shopping center if we see someone? My husband's great. There'll be this child on the floor kicking and screaming and pounding because his parent didn't get them a candy bar, and the parent will be going on down the aisle, and he'll go up to the parent and he'll say, you did the right thing. Just ignore it and it'll go away. And he's right. Pretty soon the kid gets up off the floor and goes and finds him. But he's real good at that.
Can we talk tomorrow about how, you know, we need to stand back and sometimes let the child lead them, whether it's good or bad, because then if we take credit for the good, we are probably also going to be blaming ourselves for what things we don't like about them.
Well, I think we need to modify that taking credit for the good. I really do believe that we need to celebrate that child's ability to create good and to give us his gifts. I think it's acknowledging that that child is a being in his own right or her own right, and that she is making his or her own choices. Rich was having his hand up.
Yeah, I was going to say just the same thing. Like the people leaving now, we need to not take it personal.
Yeah.
when our kids screw up or even when our kids do well. And I think the enmeshment thing of letting them go further and further away and letting them become their own individual being and not an extension of me or my ability to parent, it's a real struggle. You know, for my son at 11 to make some big mess and for me not to feel responsible for that is a, you know, it's a difficult thing. It's something that's my problem.
Yes.
That was just a quick paraphrase.
Good. What, do you want to say it your way?
I was reading your mind.
I was just going to say, I think it's real important for us not to see our kids as extensions of ourselves.
I think that's a real trap.
Yeah, yeah. And what they do doesn't reflect
on you.
Reflect on us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When I was in a junior high, that was the biggest problem. Mm-hmm. Kids whose parents came to bail them out were the ones always in the most trouble because their parents assumed responsibility for their kids' behavior. And it was the worst thing that could possibly do.
On the other hand, parents that aren't interested enough to go with the child and try to, you know, help them resolve a difficulty,
yeah,
I think are
different.
Also neglectful.
Yeah, that's
yeah, but that's
not
different.
The kids
it's like the athlete parent, the typical little league mother or father that's trying to live out their frustrated athletic abilities in this child. You know, it can be very damaging.
To me, that's the difference between responsible to my child for parental guidance and responsible for my child for what he does, and therefore if he screws up, it means me too.
A real difference.
Sure.
And therefore they deny that the kid screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
See,
yeah, yeah, that's a big
no, I'm kidding. You could possibly do that. No, I'm kidding. Sure. You know, it's just all the time.
Yeah, I think they look at it like if my kid screwed up. Yeah. It's like I did that. I got caught up into that some when my oldest was two.
Mm-hmm.
And when she would hit somebody or bite somebody, I would feel like it was me that had done that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would look at this child and it was just...
Well, and they look at you. Mm-hmm. Whoa, what's the matter with your kid?
Well,
you just
yeah.
bit my kid.
Yeah.
You know, and I think...
Being able to just separate from them. And
I think there, you know, there's a lot of critical people in the world, and I think in a way... I like to think about building emotional barriers or shields that in order to repel those and bounce them off, I have to remind myself, hey, I am me, my child is my child. If this person's bombarding me with this criticism, I have to just kind of bounce it back rather than being the sponge that I grew up being and taking it all in, feeling terrible. That an emotional shield can be a very healthy thing. And I think sometimes extended families, although they can be very nurturing, can also be very critical. That they're often in a family as a person who, if that were my kid, I'd do this or that.
Or even my kids, I don't remember my kids.